whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-up questions are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Sure. I'm Antonia Peacock. I'm currently assistant professor of philosophy at Stanford, and I work primarily on mental action, which has some philosophy of mind, some epistemology associated with it, and then also in aesthetics.
Well, it's great to have you on the podcast, and I'm excited to ask you the questions we have lined up. But before I do that, I wanted to ask, are those two interests in philosophy of mind and aesthetics, like how closely connected are they, and how much are they sort of just separate tracks?
Yeah, it's funny. I think both of them come out of my interest in normativity more broadly. So why do any norms apply to the things that we think and how we think about it? And those questions get asked very differently in epistemology versus aesthetics. That's something I had to discover about the connection. I don't think that there's any intention behind my working on both of those things. I'm just independently drawn to them.
Can I put you on the spot and ask you one more question then about that? So when you say that the norms are appealed to very differently in epistemology and then in aesthetics, could you say more about what the difference is and how it sort of complicates things?
Yeah. So one way of thinking about it is in terms of obligations versus permissions or perhaps some other kind of normative structure. So folks will sometimes say, well, epistemic norms are about what you should and shouldn't believe, right? So at least there's some obligations you have. Perhaps there's some things you're not allowed to do as a believer. But aesthetics doesn't really seem to place demands on us in the same way. Perhaps they're a kind of enticing norms is a term that's been used. Or perhaps if you're going in for a certain practice already, then there's a certain kind of normative structure to that aesthetic world that you want to engage in. But it's not as though as an experiencer or as a being in the world, you automatically have aesthetic obligations, although I think you do already have epistemic obligations.
Well, there's more I could ask you about there, but maybe it will come up later indirectly in response to one of the questions I'm going to ask later. So rather than preempting that, I'm just going to turn to my inspiration, Iris Murdoch, who begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but who also wrote, "To do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth." So would you say your temperament influences your philosophical work? And if so, how?
Yeah. In thinking about this, I wrote down a bunch of facts about my temperament, which I thought, surely this has to have some impact on how I do philosophy. So I'm really stubborn and I'm very anxious and I'm kind of silly. And I didn't really think of any way in which these things actually influence the way I do philosophy. But there is one thing that I think is relevant here, which is I have a kind of love-hate relationship with my unconscious mind when it comes to doing philosophy. And what I mean by that is I've found out I really need to be patient with the kinds of seemingly irrational frustrations or urges or temptations I have when making my way around a question in philosophy. Like if something's bothering me, I can't just brute force figure out what that is and pay attention to it all the time. Sometimes I have to back off from it, let it stew in the back of my mind for days and come back to it. But it's usually meaningful. So I also can't ignore that thing in the back of my mind. So I guess what I've learned about my own temperament in doing philosophy is that there's something back there that seems to influence what I think that I have to make my peace with, even though I sometimes get frustrated by it.
That's very interesting. I have questions about the other traits you mentioned as well. I'm not sure if this will go anywhere, but stubbornness is very interesting to me as a trait for philosophers, because I think philosophers often seem stubborn in argument, partly because of the style in which philosophy is often practiced, but it also is, it has a kind of role to play in finding, there's a kind of challenge of finding a balance where if you're too quick to give up and you're not stubborn enough in defending your views, it's very hard to do philosophy. But there's always the fear that one is too stubborn and sort of unreceptive. And I mean, is stubbornness something you sort of experience in doing philosophy and feel yourself negotiating with? Like, how does that show up?
Yeah, I completely agree with you about the role of stubbornness in philosophy. I think a lot of philosophers are stubborn in certain ways. I think you have to be, to stick with such difficult questions where the conceptual terrain isn't always already mapped out for you. You know, not only are you trying to answer some questions, but you're trying to figure out which ones to ask in the first place. So if you didn't have a certain amount of stubbornness, or maybe grit is a more positively valenced word for it, you might not be in the profession at all. But for me, my experience of stubbornness, it'll sometimes come down to the following structure. I will think P, I'll think P, I'll think P, and then I'll get a reason to think not P, and that'll percolate again in the back of my mind until one day the whole edifice comes crumbling down and I think, oh my God, I can't believe I thought P at all in the first place. But I rarely experience a more gradual shift in view. It seems more like an edifice suddenly crumbles when I change my mind.
I'm so curious. Do you have an example that springs to mind of where that's happened, either large scale or trivial, in which something you were clinging to, you realize has just collapsed?
Yeah, totally. Actually, this relates to one of the other questions I think you might ask me.
Yes.
So in many ways, I'm a realist. I think that most of what we think about the world normatively and aesthetically is true, and true in a way that doesn't depend on what each of us individually thinks about it. And the way that this manifested in some metaphysics classes that I had taught had to do with the A theory and B theory of time. So these are terribly named theories, right? Maybe the worst named theories in all philosophy for how little they say about what they are. But A theorists like to think that there are some fundamental time facts that have to be expressed in terms of what's past, present, and future. Whereas B theorists think it's just the before and after relations you need to express all of the fundamental time facts. So if you're an A theorist, you're probably the type of person who thinks, oh yeah, there's something fundamental about the now, that present moment. And we don't have a total picture of the way the universe is unless we can place which moment in time is the privileged present, as it's sometimes called. So as a more generally a realist, I was attracted to this. I think this is a really fundamental part of the way that we experience our lives. But A theory and B theory also have physical implications, and that can be troubling for philosophers who aren't paying attention to the physics underlying these views. So a popular argument against A theory, against the existence of a privileged present, has to do with special relativity, which I guess I won't get into here now, although it's one of the most fascinating arguments. And I just changed my mind when I saw the way in which special relativity influences the reasonableness of thinking that there is a privileged present. I held on to it for a long time, but I've completely flipped the other way now.
Well, you said this would connect with another question I was going to ask. And I'm going to guess that this is what's now question two. Has philosophy ever helped you out of a practical or emotional difficulty in your life?
Yeah. As a kid, I was really afraid of dying, perhaps neurotically afraid of dying, not just in the natural way that all of us tend to be afraid of dying. I would not be able to sleep at night because I was thinking about it. I would literally squirm in my bed sheets. I would get frustrated. I would demand attention from my my ever-patient parents on this issue. And actually changing my mind about A theory and B theory has given me a different perspective on what a human life is with respect to the movement of time. So insofar as you think there isn't really a privileged present in any way, then it starts to look weirder to think that what's now is only real temporarily. And it looks a lot more natural alongside B theory to say, actually, things in the past and things in the future, or at least what we would otherwise have called past and future, if we're going to be good B theorists, they're just as real in some fundamental metaphysical way. And so when the privileged present, so to speak, seems to move from one moment to another, that isn't making anything less real or fundamental than it was before. And so similarly, if you have a perspective on your life near the end of it, where you're looking back at something that came before, it can be troubling to think that that's not real anymore, that it's gone, that it simply doesn't exist. It's not part of the fabric of the universe anymore. Whereas if you think that the past is on a par with the present when it comes to reality, that's less troubling, I think.
Wow. Does this affect your daily life much? Do you feel like you're unburdened in a sort of meaningful way by seeing things differently? It seems like this sort of sense of fundamental reality was connected in a deep way with your anxiety about death.
Yeah, it's actually become a voice in my head. So as an anxious person, negative things will pop to mind unbidden, right? This is part of me making peace with this back of my mind. And it's helpful to have responses to those things. So when I fear that I'm running out of time, or when I fear that something is almost over, or when I fear that death is just around the corner, which, by the way, I think constantly, it's really constantly. Yeah, it's actually really helpful to have the response to say, well, what's gone isn't really gone, or I should say, what's temporally over from my individual perspective isn't really any less real. That's still there in some sense. It's just that I'm not currently living through it. Just as it's not really reasonable to be afraid that what's behind your back is gone when you're looking in one direction, it's not really reasonable to be afraid that what's in your apparent past is gone when you're living seemingly in one present moment.
I'm really fascinated by this in part because I also suffered and continue to suffer from what seems like an excessive fear of death. So I'm very curious about strategies that would help with it. Uh-huh. I'm also extremely impatient, and I'm kind of wondering, what does this shift in your relation to time make you more patient too? Because I suppose there's also the thought, I want this to happen now. But if it's all equally real, then happens tomorrow, happens next year. What difference does it make?
That's a really good point. I am a very impatient person. Uh-huh. And that's not necessarily about sort of how far I am in temporal distance, so to speak, from an event. That's one way of being impatient, right? To say, I wish it was happening now, not 2 hours from now,
yeah.
Right? Another way of being impatient is to think time is a limited resource and what's going on now is taking up some of that resource. And I would like to have the thing that's in the future be pushed forward. I would like to be there sooner only because what's intervening between where I am now and that future event is a waste of time. And I think that second kind of impatience is my kind of impatience.
That way of putting it really does pull apart different elements in fear of death too. Because one thing one might be afraid of in dying is just there. I want more time. I don't want to die sooner rather than later because I just want there to be more time in my life. And I take it that isn't really addressed by the shift from being an A theorist to a B theorist, thinking that there's an objective present, and to thinking time is more like a kind of space-like dimension. the limited resource problem remains, but there was something else behind the fear of death, which had to do with sort of the reality of what you're experiencing being extinguished.
I completely agree. I don't think that aspect of a fear of death is addressed by anything much in the metaphysics of time, unfortunately. But yeah, for me, the fear of death, and I think the reason it came up around sleep was because sleep seems so similar to death in this regard, was a kind of annihilation of consciousness or non-presence, an absence. And that seemed ununderstandable to me, and not just non-imaginable, but I got really confused in an eerie way. And it's helped me to reframe from thinking there will be a time when reality excludes anything that is me to thinking, no, what is me is something with a certain kind of perspective in time. I exist in a certain stretch of time, or I should say location in space-time to be more careful about it. But that's not to say that there's anything unreal about me when you go to other locations in space-time.
I think at this point we've covered stubbornness, anxiety, impatience. We haven't talked enough about silliness, so maybe we'll get back to silliness. But I'm gonna ask you question three. Is there a trait you wish you had more of as a philosopher?
It's so funny that this came up after talking about impatience, because I was gonna say I want to be more patient. Well, okay. What I want is to be more willing to sit in a kind of uncertainty and wonder state. A lot of the philosophers that I really admire, people like Bernard Williams and Thomas Nagel, and reaching further back, Wittgenstein and Hume, a lot of them asked really, really good questions that they didn't know the answer to. And they were able to do that in a way that filled out the color in this question, that made it seem exciting and rich. And I love reading those pieces of philosophy, and I would love to be able to write them, and I haven't been able to yet. I don't know if that counts as patience. I think it requires a lot of perhaps intellectual dispositions I haven't yet nurtured enough in myself, but I'd like to one day.
I totally resonate to that. No, I have a constant conflict between the sense that I need to be patient enough to really think seriously and the sense that the urgency of anxiety about philosophical problems is the only reason I ever get anything done. I mean, philosophical work. I love this point about questions too. I was reading somewhere recently that someone did a count of the questions in Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations and said there are 784 questions and 110 answers, all but 40 of which are mistaken, or at least intended by Wittgenstein to be mistaken. So there is this sense of asking good questions. This is definitely one of those questions about questions that's too hard to expect anyone to answer on the spot, but I'll ask it anyway and see what happens, which is there is this sense of like a deep value in philosophy of asking good questions that's independent to some extent of any particular answers that those questions might receive. It's not like being really good at asking the right questions as an engineer because these are the ones that enable you to solve the engineering problem. Or maybe it is. Maybe that is what's going on in philosophy. But I feel like I have a sense of the value of questions that is not in that way instrumental. I guess discuss. Do you think that's right? Is that what you have in mind when you talk about your sort of appreciation for questions?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a way of thinking of a question where you would need to know what the possible answers would even look like in order to understand the question itself.
Yeah.
So yes, no questions are usually like this, right? You need to have a grasp on some proposition P to be able to ask reasonably, aptly, the question, is P true? So that you would have a sense of what the answer yes or no would mean. I think a lot of the questions in philosophy are explanatory questions. And I think explanations come in many kinds. And one of the puzzling, disorienting, and wonderful things about Wittgenstein is that he's able to ask questions where it's not entirely clear what the form of an answer should even be to that question. And that leads you to think whether this is even a good question in the first place, which I think is a good way of intellectually responding to some of the stuff in Wittgenstein's investigations. I will add that I think, for what it's worth, which might not be much, it is a totally different cognitive skill, being able to look at a philosophical question that already exists and make some suggestions about how to answer it versus asking your own. I'm really lucky to be at Stanford. These students are incredible. They anticipate a bunch of my lectures. They write these beautiful papers in response to the prompts that I give them. It's a genuine joy and a little intimidating at times. But when it comes time to give them the assignment of coming up with their own question about a text, sometimes they're just lost. And this can make me really sad because I think it's one of the central skills of a philosophical education that you should be able to ask something that is intrinsically interesting to you and that isn't a question posed by one of your instructors on your behalf, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I love that. No, I that seems totally right to me. And it points towards the next question a little bit, because it's sort of about the role of imagination in philosophy. And so I'm going to ask you a question that might be about that. Is there a work of art that you love in part for its philosophical depth?
Yeah, there's so many. I had to choose. I didn't want to just list things. I don't know if you've read Rachel Cusk's Outline trilogy.
I have read Outline, yeah.
I think it's absolutely brilliant. Highly recommend reading Transit and Kudos as well. One of the things that she tries to do, even just in that first book, Outline, is to give you a sense of how a character is and isn't shaped by the narratives they tell. So let me say a bit what I mean by that. The narrator, Faye, of Outline, hardly says anything about her own life. The book is largely a recounting of the stories other people tell her about their own lives. And it's remarkable how little you feel her hand in the retelling of these narratives in the narration that is Outline. But you get a sense of who these people are, not because of the facts they're relaying about what's happened to them or what they're telling you about who is in their family and what they do for a job, but rather because of the way they tell their own stories. There's this wonderful, I don't think this is a spoiler, but if you're a spoiler phobe, please feel free to close your ears for a moment. At the end of Outline, the narrator, Faye, is an author. She's temporarily in Athens to teach a writing class. At the end of Outline, somebody comes to take her place in the apartment she's been renting. The person who comes to take her place is also an author who will also be teaching a writing class. And there's this wonderful moment at which these two authors think, well, there's a sense in which somebody else's story in its telling can give you a shape in Outline. That is the negative space that you provide around the story somebody else tells is itself a kind of shaping of you. That's part of what I love about Outline. I have not regretted a single time I've reread that book.
That was an amazing description. Yeah, no, I love that novel too. It's funny, I love it, but I never was somehow motivated to read the sequels, which I should now do. I mean, she's also, in her essays, I think Rachel Cusk is also very, writes in interesting ways about sort of the peculiarities of narrative. I think she tells somewhere the story, I won't remember the details exactly, of a very old woman who kills a young girl at a pedestrian crossing. And her entire life story is changed by this incident. And it kind of prompts a discussion of how unusual that is. And that isn't a way life narrative normally works. And Yeah, she is incredibly good on that theme, I think.
Absolutely. I think part of what's interesting about hearing through the narrator's retelling, hearing these narrations from characters in Outline, is the way in which the adoption of a moment as a significant moment in your story can constitute its becoming a significant moment in your story. So I think part of what I'm interested in with respect to agency, both mental and otherwise, connects well with this conception of narrative. Your own life story is partly something that you tell, that you make true by the telling of it, if that makes sense.
Right. And it's dangerous and sort of it's risky, this kind of self-constitution. Yeah. Well, with regret, I have to turn to the final question, which we've anticipated a bit, but we'll see where it goes. This is another Iris Murdoch question, beginning with a quote. It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher, she wrote. What is she afraid of? So what are you afraid of?
I'm afraid of a lot of things as a dispositionally anxious person, but I'll tell you about one of the things I'm meaningfully afraid of, which is, I think, a kind of Proustian fear. I was torn about whether to say Proust or Cusk in response to the work of art question. I'm really afraid that I'll never really know another person, you know, where that fear isn't just a kind of loneliness or uncertainty about individual relationships, but rather a structural worry about the way in which we share our lives with one another. It takes an immense skill and intellectual care and patience to be able to properly communicate what's going on for you to somebody else, and vice versa. And so the efforts that we make at understanding what it's like for each other are often bumbling and incomplete and self-serving. And that really scares me. You know, there is a structural sense in which all of us individually, each of us, I should say, is alone in her experience of the world. And that I find terrifying.
I mean, do you think it's a real possibility to overcome that aloneness, to really know someone in the way you're afraid you don't? Or is what you're afraid of in that circumstance really something that's not even possible? Is it a kind of fear, a fear that is, you sort of know, bound to be fulfilled?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not a skeptic about other minds, so I'm not philosophically committed to the idea that you can't know what's going on for somebody else. And I think that there are many gradations of epistemic intimacy, you might call it, where I know my partner really well, and I don't know the barista who serves a coffee or all of my students. I don't know them as well. But part of what scares me is not always being able to tell the difference. We have to make a lot of assumptions about what life is like for one another in order to be good to one another, in order to share activities and pleasures with one another. And there isn't always a very good corrective when we're wrong about something, when we make the wrong assumptions. And we often serve our own, perhaps unrealistic, self-images when we think, oh yeah, I must have gotten it right. I really empathize with her plight here. I must be understanding what this is like. So I don't think that what I'm afraid of is bound to come to pass necessarily. I think part of the reason this fear is active in my life is because it's a daily, literally daily labor of love to figure out for one another what we are going through.
Well, I think that's a great place to end the conversation and say thank you, Antonia, for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the podcast.
Antonia Peacock is Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Stanford University. She's the author of How to Think Several Thoughts at Once, How Literature Expands Your Imagination, and other essays in Aesthetics and the Philosophy of Mind. Thanks for listening to Five Questions.